now. Humidity still a tad high, 71%. Wind from the southwest at 13, gusting to 21. 76 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you'll hear a newly recorded interview with the author of a book about climate change, which explores what it would take to not only stop climate change, but also to reverse some of the damages which it has done. In part two, from the archives, a conversation with the author of a book called Young China, which looks at the young adults of China and how they are likely to change their country and the world. Here's part one. We're going to be talking on this portion of WGTD's morning show about one of the most important, perhaps the most important issues and concerns of the day, climate change, and the catastrophic possibility of a future under that very dark cloud. But we're looking at climate change today through very different eyes and through the lens of a new book called Climate Restoration, which calls on the human race to not just stop what is causing climate change, but to actually seek to restore the climate of our planet. That is, to restore it to conditions that it was were once seen on this planet, and when life was much easier and better for human beings and for all creatures for that matter. Such a possibility might seem audacious indeed, but not according to the co-authors of this new book called Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. It is the contention of the co-authors of this book, Peter Fikowski, and my morning show guest, Carol Douglas, that there are technologies that exist today that might very well make possible the removal of excess CO2 from the atmosphere. And through a concerted effort to utilize these technologies, it might actually be possible not only to stop the causes of climate change, but in a sense to reverse the ravages that excess carbon dioxide has caused. And it is a fascinating proposition and important. And I'm really glad that we can have a few minutes to speak with Carol Douglas, an award-winning journalist who has written extensively about climate change and sustainability issues for several decades. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Psychology Today, Harper's, and in an array of books from the National Geographic Society. This current book is published by Rivertowns Books, again titled Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. Carol Douglas, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. You really sound like you've absorbed the messages. I appreciate that.
No problem. Tell us how you first connected with your co-author, Peter Fikowski, and the circumstances under which you co-wrote this book.
Well, Peter Fikowski is a physicist, entrepreneur, Silicon Valley engineer, and has spent about 10 years researching and discovering how we might reclaim the climate that will allow us to survive and thrive in the future. I hooked up with him through people I know in the environmental field. And since I had written about climate before, we became writing partners. He's the prime mover. He is the moving force behind this new movement called climate restoration. And climate restoration means, as you brought up, restoring the climate that humans have survived long term. It's bringing the climate back to the way it was in pre-industrial times so that farmers know when to plant. We don't have these monster storms and floods, these disabling droughts and crazy wildfires. And we get back to a world that we know how to live on and flourish in. That's the goal of climate restoration. And as you say, we already know how to do it. We have the know-how. We have the technology, which is all based on natural processes. We even have financing. We don't need government funding, although it would help kick it off. All that's missing is the will. All that's missing is for everyone to stand up, let their voice be heard, that we insist on climate restoration as the goal of climate action. That's not our current goal.
One of the chief points of the book is that the standards laid out in the Paris Climate Accords are not enough. And of course, even there, the Climate Accords of Paris have not been adopted by every single country on Earth. And the United States, for a time, of course, under President Donald Trump, stepped decisively away from the Paris Climate Accords and its goals. But even if we were all on board, if every nation on board, on the Earth was on board with the Paris Climate Accords, that would not be enough. That would be far from enough in terms of making the planet what we want it and need it to be. Explain why that is not sufficient.
You're absolutely right. I think most people think that we're aiming at a livable climate, but actually the world's current climate goal is to reduce carbon emissions until we reach net zero emissions by 2050. In other words, not putting any more in. That's the focus of the United Nations, the Paris goal, as you say, and that's what most climate activists are working on. And it's really important for lots of reasons. It's also, as you say, wholly insufficient, because if we stop burning fossil fuels, even if we stop, we will still be left with this gigantic pool of CO2 lingering in the atmosphere, which we've pumped up there in the last two centuries. And when I say gigantic, I mean it. There's an extra trillion tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. If we don't put any more in, that's good. But what's better, what's a more sensible climate goal is to take that out, because it's the CO2 that's up there already and we're still adding to that is causing the climate havoc.
So one of the things that your book spells out are four different technologies that currently exist, I mean, to varying degrees, that are essentially technologies designed for the removal of excess CO2 from the atmosphere. And, of course, we would leave it to people to explore these in depth by looking at your book. But summarize for us these four different technologies that currently exist that could be brought to bear on this issue of excess CO2 in the atmosphere.
Thank you. Yes, we say that we can remove this excess CO2 by 2050 because Mother Nature removes CO2 all the time from the atmosphere. And now we know precisely how she does it, and we have figured out how to copy and accelerate the processes in an approach called biomimicry. We do what happens naturally, but on an accelerated scale. So here's an example. Nature constantly packs away CO2 in the form of limestone. Limestone is magical. Limestone is nearly half, by weight, CO2. It's calcium carbonate, calcium plus CO2. So think about the White Cliffs of Dover. Most of the carbon in the world is in cliffs and shelves like that. It comes from oysters, clams, corals, and all kinds of other little tiny marine animals. They make their shells out of calcium carbonate. Then when they die, those shells drop to the seafloor, and eventually they get compressed into limestone. So again, limestone is nearly half CO2 by weight, and that's a permanent storage system. It's not coming out of limestone. So recently, scientists have figured out how to make synthetic limestone. From CO2 they pull out of the air, and calcium they're now getting from recycled concrete. This synthetic limestone, it's pure, it's manufactured, it's tested and standardized. It's being used, it's used for building and for making the aggregate that goes into concrete, terrific quality concrete. It doesn't have to be developed. It's happening right now. For example, the San Francisco airport has already built a terminal using this carbon negative concrete. The company, Blue Planet Systems, has recently built a plant in the Bay Area. And it's so, the San Francisco Airport Authority has purchased its entire output for the next 2 years to build terminals and runways. So there's a huge demand for this climate restoring project. A lot of people talk about pulling carbon dioxide out of the air and sticking it underground or something, but that's humongously expensive and slow. Instead, we pull it out in a natural way, more natural way, and store it away in products that there's a tremendous demand for. That's one. The others include, very briefly, restoring the fertility of the oceans. We all know that the oceans are dying, and it's not just because of overfishing and coral bleaching. A healthy ocean is green because it has a lot of photosynthesis going on. And photosynthesis, of course, is done by green plants, both tiny phytoplankton and large seaweed. And in healthy parts of the ocean, the photosynthesis is so intense that, for one thing, it restores fisheries, it restores the chain of life in the oceans. And again, that intense photosynthesis pulls in a lot of CO2, and whatever isn't eaten goes down, when it dies, it sinks towards the depths of the ocean where it doesn't rot. Unlike trees, they photosynthesize too, and they're great, but eventually they rot or they burn. Seaweed doesn't. So, other sea plants, they don't. So that's another way, another nature biomimicked way of drawing down a lot of CO2. And the others, there's a couple of more. Mm-hmm. Well, one is farming larger seaweed, and that they photosynthesize like crazy. Kelp can grow 2 feet a day. So you can use some of it, and then some of it will sink and take the CO2 down to the depths of the ocean. I find this absolutely fascinating. People have recently figured out how to use kelp and other seaweed, sargassum, as a substitute for petroleum. I kid you not. You can make biofuel out of it. You can make all kinds of foods and food products out of the kelp version. You can make fertilizers, the basis for medicines, and even plastics and a vegan leather out of seaweed. So that's starting to take off, and that's very exciting.
What's interesting to me, among other things, is that in at least one of these cases, it sounds like we're talking about a technology that was not developed from the start with this climate issue in mind, or at least not primarily. I mean, that these, at least some of these technologies are perhaps with us for other reasons and can, in a sense, be redirected to this pressing, even paramount issue of climate change. Is that fair to say?
In some cases, absolutely, yes. People have been farming seaweed forever. It's very, very big in parts of Asia. In fact, there's components of seaweed in a lot of our products, particularly ice cream. Some of this is newer. So that's a traditional industry. Some of these newer efforts are being designed specifically with the carbon dioxide removal aspect in mind, in such a way that they make products that people will buy. And that's really important, because if you take CO2 out of the air and you stick it in the ground, that doesn't do anything for anyone, right? You're not making anything useful. You just have to keep paying for that to happen, and it's quite expensive. If you take CO2 out of the air or the ocean, and you make something useful with it, you sell it in a very large scale, not little things, but on a large scale. You make synthetic limestone or these kelp farms, you're actually creating a market so that it can pay for itself. You enrich the fertility of the oceans in certain small areas. The fisheries come back, and climate restoration then is paid for by the fishing market. So that's, I find, just absolutely intriguing, and I think that's a large part of what will make this successful, is that it only takes investment for which there will be some return. It doesn't take, trillions of government dollars.
One thing that is compelling about at least some of these possibilities is that it is a matter of turning to nature and to some of the climate restoration that Mother Nature herself or itself has already achieved earlier in our planet's history. That, in fact, this is not something, in a sense, utterly new. And there's something sort of oddly reassuring about the thought that some of these efforts would, in a sense, piggyback on, or in some ways even sort of mimic, what the planet Earth itself has done before earlier in its history.
Exactly, exactly right. In fact, this trillion tons of CO2 happens to be the same amount that nature has withdrawn from the atmosphere 10 times over the last million years. CO2 mounts up, gets very, very high. These things kick in. Photosynthesis goes crazy in the ocean, and little shelled creatures are busy building their shells and making limestone, and the temperature and CO2 levels drop. You can see this on a map of the last million years, a graph of the CO2 ups and downs. So, of course, when nature does it, it happens over thousands of years, and we need it to happen over decades. But we know how to do it, yes. It's not like putting enormous mirrors in the sky or, stuff like that, which may have its own merits, but this is, it's biomimicked, and sometimes we call it geomimicry as well, creating synthetic limestone.
What would you gauge the level of preparedness in terms of these technologies? I suspect that in order to do this and to accomplish it, the technologies need further development, further refinement, and so on. I'm not even sure how one gauges that or scales that sort of thing. But, I mean, where are these technologies at this moment?
Great question. they are developed. They are researched, they're developed, and what we think is that they need to be scaled up and can be scaled up enough to withdraw the quantities needed over the over this decade and then work at full tilt for the next 20 years so that we are done by 2050. They've all been tested. They've all been demonstrated. They work. Well, one of them is a little, yeah. The three that I mentioned, they work. And, of course, like any large project, they're being refined all the time. And, of course, like with any large project, they will be consistently, constantly monitored so that if anything should go awry, it can be course corrected. It's a project. The synthetic limestone, as I mentioned, San Francisco Airport is all over it. And they have new plants going up in Europe and other places. The seaweed, it's called, one of the projects is called a marine permaculture array, meaning that you have these frames that you set out in precise areas in the open ocean, so you're not near the shore, and kelp can attach to these frames, and it becomes a whole little mini ecosystem. The fish come for habitat, and then the little, you know, the big fish eat the little fish and all that stuff. It has been developed. It's still in process of scaling. So it's in some process of demonstration.
A last question: how would you characterize the receptiveness of the overall scientific community to some of these possibilities?
Yes, it varies a lot. Our premise is that everyone wants to restore a safe climate, a climate that we know is safe because humans have survived in it long term. That's our premise. And that for it to happen, we need to make climate restoration our goal. It's not going to happen just if we keep saying all we need to do is stop emissions. We need to make it our goal. Now, a lot of the scientists have spent their careers following the UN and other directives, agreements, and worked for 20, 30, 40 years on reducing emissions as the goal. So they're not always receptive to this whole new paradigm of saying, that's not good enough. You know, when you're flying a plane, one of your objectives is not to crash. But you also need a goal to get to New York by 3 o'clock with everyone safely and get everybody out. So we have, our current goal is simply not to crash, to avoid the worst of climate chaos. We're suggesting we need to make the goal actually restoring the climate that we know we can survive on. So that's kind of, it's really a paradigm shift. Once we make that the goal, there will be a whole lot more science, a whole lot more activity, a whole lot. For instance, one of these big four, which is restoring fertility and photosynthesis in the ocean, there's currently a consortium of about 40 universities around the world who study oceanography and marine biology, and they are they're planning to look into that from all kinds of aspects. However, the only way you really know that it will work is to do it. And it has been done, and it did work. So, yeah, people are in varying stages of acceptance and enthusiasm about climate restoration.
Well, it certainly is an intriguing notion, and one that comes from a place of ultimate optimism. And this is a book that is carefully and meticulously crafted, and in reading it, one can explore all of these intriguing possibilities further. The book, again, is titled Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. It is published by Rivertowns Books. The co-author, Peter Fikowski, and my morning show guest, Carol Douglas. Carol Douglas, thank you for being with me on the morning show today and for having this intriguing conversation. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. We're speaking about China today on The Morning Show. Actually, we're going to be speaking especially about young people in China because of a remarkably interesting new book called Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. The book is written by Zach Deichwald, who moved to China shortly after graduating from Columbia University. He has now relocated here to the United States, but speaks Mandarin fluently and still spends a considerable amount of time in China. He has many friends there and professional connections and has written a book that is just incredibly compelling. And it really helps us, shakes us loose from some of the assumptions that Westerners tend to carelessly make about the nation of China. And in particular, the simplistic, sweeping generalizations that we tend to make about that enormous country and the role that it plays in the world and what life is like for its many citizens. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Again, it's titled Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. And Zach Deichwald, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
One of the reasons I especially appreciate reading this book is because I, in my other life, teach at a local liberal arts college, and that school has quite a powerful connection with China. And in the music department where I happen to teach, we almost always have a number of young people from China who are actually studying music here. And they have been a vibrant addition to our department. But reading your book makes me realize how little I know about where they come from, and in a sense also how little I know about them. So I really appreciate this opportunity to explore your book and to understand more about this really important country. What initially drew you to that part of the world?
You know, as goofy as this sounds, it was originally science fiction. I was a big science fiction junkie growing up, and when I was deciding where to study abroad as a 20-year-old, I figured I could go to Europe and study history, or I could go to China and see where everyone was saying the future was happening. When you set it up like that, it's a kind of easy decision.
Explain the difference between, for instance, visiting Hong Kong and then crossing over into mainland China. Mm-hmm. What kind of a different experience that was?
It's almost night and day. You know, when you think culturally, at least, Hong Kong is not mainland China. It's a distinct entity. So I actually studied abroad first in Hong Kong, and I write in the book that after about a week or two, I was looking around and said, wow, this feels almost disappointingly manageable. You know, Hong Kong is such a good middle ground, famously so, between the East and West. When you go into China, it's an entirely different experience. It's far more culturally distant. And a big part of that is because it's so linguistically distant as well.
One thing that was intriguing to me is that when you first sort of made your way into mainland China, in a sense, you didn't find it revelatory. You describe it as being kind of the opposite experience. You write, seeing more of China didn't make me understand it better. It only created more mysteries to solve.
this is one of the interesting parts about China, is because the linguistics and culture is so distant from what we have in the West, it's very difficult to understand. I became convinced that you couldn't understand China on a two-week trip to Shanghai, on a business trip. You couldn't understand it from a hutong in Beijing even, or a boardroom in Shanghai. So I wanted to put myself in it. I wanted to feel, you know, the taste, the energy, the heartbeat of the country. Living there, living with, you know, only Chinese roommates, my friends were all Chinese, and really maintaining a fairly strict Chinese mental diet, which means the movies I watch, the music I listen to, the conversations I have, they were all in Chinese. You sort of begin to sink into the culture far more slowly, but added to a deeper, more intimate level. You start to understand what people are excited about, what people are afraid of. My definition of fluency, this might shed a little bit of light, was that if one of my Chinese friends had a breakup or was having an emotional crisis, they could call me, complain, I would understand and be able to console them in Chinese. And then the next day, if things kicked off in North Korea, I would be able to have a conversation about nuclear deterrence as well. So being able to have those type of deeper, more nuanced conversations, that's how you really get to know and understand a people.
I'm so glad that in the opening chapter to your book, you evoke images from those spectacular opening ceremonies for the Beijing Olympics in 2008, which you tell us was an opportunity for China to beam a new image of itself to the world, an image of immaculate synchronicity, a unified, homogenous, tightly choreographed glide into the future, a blurring of the individuals, the spectacular beauty of the whole. China telling the world it was a balanced and unified nation striding in lockstep toward its future. But then you go on to tell us that the reality of China could not be more different. Explain the way in which China is, in fact, a drastically fragmented nation.
Well, it's interesting that you point to the Olympics, because that image was being beamed to the rest of the world, but it was also being beamed to the Chinese themselves. You know, if you're a young person in China, you remember maybe the first time you saw the United States was the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. And at that point in time, China was quite poor. I have a friend who recounts his parents were telling him at the time that, wow, look at America, that's the most developed country in the world. And then to watch your country by 2008 be able to put on a performance that was known as the best performance in history, to the young person in China, that was a very powerful message. Because traditionally, China is fragmented. It used to be known as a sheet of loose sand. That's what Sun Yat-sen referred to it after the abdication in 1911 of the emperor. You have so many different regions in China that all have different languages. So if I was born in, say I'm born in Wisconsin and I was trying to talk to someone from California, we would not be able to communicate. Someone from Shanghai talking to someone from Guangdong province in Shenzhen in southern China close to Hong Kong, they are not able to have a conversation in a bar if they are both speaking their local dialects. So a big part of China modernizing has been becoming a more unified nation. Putonghua, so Mandarin, is a big effort in that direction, having people from all across the country being able to converse in a common language. But you have a wide wealth gap, and then even larger generation gaps, the gap between this young generation in China and the older generation in China. There's no greater fragment in China than that one.
You tell us, in fact, that in China, it tends to think of its generations by decades. So those born in the 50s, those born in the 60s, those born in the 70s, and you tell us that in fact we're talking about vast differences of attitude, and particularly for the elderly in China, they to this day struggle to understand China's place in the world compared to what it once was in their own formative years.
In order to contextualize just how much change has taken place, around the time that my parents were deciding whether or not to go to Woodstock, you know, I don't know if anyone listening can relate to that, but my parents talk about, you know, what were they doing that weekend? My dad decided not to go. My friend's parents in China that same year, I have friends, parents, who were eating tree bark to stave off starvation. The amount China has changed in the last few decades is so far beyond our comprehension. I'll give you one more example. I'm born in 1990. In my lifetime, the per capita GDP in the United States, you know, the average living experience for most people in the United States, has improved 2.5 times, which is really remarkable for a developed country. In China, if you were born in the same year, the per capita GDP has increased 25 times. They've gone from rags to riches in their lifetime. So the older generation, 他们老一辈被称为吃苦的一代, it means the older generation in China has been known as the eat bitter generation. They were defined by their ability to withstand hardship for long periods of time at the prospect of delayed gratification. And sometimes that gratification, by the way, was not just delayed to their lifetime, but to the next generation, working hard to try to pull themselves out of poverty.
Hmm.
This young generation, you know, they're not asking themselves subsistence questions. They're not asking themselves, how do I get enough to eat? How do I provide safety for my family, for my children? They're asking themselves, who do I want to be? What do I want for myself, my family, my country? They're identity questions, which is why I call them the restless generation. When you're asking yourself identity questions, there's inevitably a restlessness that comes with trying to define who you are, what you stand for.
Hmm. Right. You tell us that some of these older Chinese still remember China being thought of as the sick man of Asia. Mm. And many still think about what was known as the century of humiliation from 1839 to 1949. And of course, now China has emerged from that in a very emphatic way. In fact, you tell us that one of the reasons there is quite a serious obesity problem with youngsters in China is because they are, to a large extent, often raised by their own grandparents who have a very different attitude about food. Explain what I'm talking about there. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, of course. So like I mentioned, a lot of the grandparents in China, particularly if they have young grandchildren, they remember the Cultural Revolution. They remember quite literally having to find enough, you know, they weren't able to find enough to eat often. So now that China is wealthier, the idea that you're going to, you know, put your kid on a diet, that you're not going to let him have that extra cookie, it's an entirely different mindset. This older generation has a privation mindset. They remember when there wasn't enough to eat. So the way that you literally express love in China was to give someone a little bit extra food. As this older generation, they call it skip generation child rearing, because the grandparents in China often raise the child as the parents both have to work. So their way of expressing love and admiration for their child is to give them a little bit extra eat. So this single child generation is often or has been overweight. They are now trying to correct that. There's a building awareness around, you know, good health, but it's something that didn't even occur to a generation that mostly grew up without enough to eat, enough to wear.
We're speaking with Zach Dykewald about his book, Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. One of the most intriguing realities and difficult realities about modern China has to do with sort of the demographics and the number of young people in China securing good education in pursuit of really good jobs, and that there simply aren't enough, that there is ferocious competition for the very best kind of jobs that a well-educated person might desire and even expect. Tell us more about the reality of the numbers when it comes to this particular matter, and kind of a perfect storm that makes this a really difficult situation for many young Chinese citizens.
Well, just to put it into context, you know, there's a big to-do about American millennials. I'm an American millennial. There's 80 million of us. In China, there are 400 million millennials, 5 times more than what we have in the United States, and more, actually, than the entire population of the U.S. and Canada combined. What's bizarre about the millennial population in China is that they're relatively small compared to the older generation. In China, it used to be that you had a lot of kids and very few old people. In 1950, the average life expectancy was only 36. So you didn't age, you died. now, because of the single child policy, the one child policy, and a massive longevity revolution, now the life expectancy is around 76, and most households only have one child. So you have what's called the 4-2-1 crisis. You have four grandparents for every two parents for every one child. With that comes a lot of attention. We talk about, you know, Xiao Huangdi, little emperors, but that also means an enormous amount of pressure. Pressure to perform in school, pressure to get into a great college, pressure to get a job. And like you mentioned, Greg, the economy and the job market has not kept up with the education levels in China. The older generation, so in 1975, only 11% of the population was high school educated. This last year, China graduated 7.5 million college graduates. You know, one-third, you mentioned that you teach at a local university, one-third of all students from abroad studying in the United States are from China, one-third. It's an enormous population that's becoming increasingly educated. But the competition for every good job is so fierce that this young generation describes a childhood defined by pressure.
You really saw that playing out in some of the teaching that you did in China of some of these so-called little emperors. First of all, just explain what that term means, and then sort of physically and visually the kind of things that you observed in terms of the enormous pressure brought to bear on these youngsters from their well-meaning parents and grandparents.
Of course. So a little emperor, Xiao Huangdi, was a term created in the 1990s to describe the single-child population in China. Around 1980, the one-child policy began to curb China's demographic. You know, it had a population that was growing rapidly. They felt that the land could not support, and so they were only allowed to have one child per family. People expected that to be a ticking time bomb, that this young generation was going to be spoiled rotten. One of the interesting experiences I had, like you mentioned, I was a teacher in Suzhou for the first 6 months I was there. And one class I taught was, it was a relatively upscale school, and I was teaching computer coding, believe it or not, and English to a young population, or excuse me, a young group of kids between the age of 3 and 6. So there are 6 kids in my class. They're adorable because they're 3 to 6-year-olds. And they didn't seem spoiled at all. They were actually extremely well-behaved. There was one kid named Zhang Guo in particular who I really took a liking to. But at the back of the class, behind a glass wall, there were 12 parents and 24 grandparents watching every single tap of the keyboard or twist of a microscope of this young population. They were scrutinizing every single move. After class, you know, we let class out, and I was talking to some of the parents, and all of a sudden I hear Zhang Guo, one of the younger, cuter kids, who you don't like to choose favorites, but it's hard not to. He was so curious and so determined to learn. I heard him wailing in the side of the room, and I look over. His mother and grandmother are showing him flashcards, microscope, dolphin, amoeba, all words I had taught the class earlier that day. I go over and ask, you know, what's going on? I didn't assign any homework. And his mother says to me, she says, I am preparing Zhang Guo for the college entrance exam. He takes it in 12 or 13 years. We're trying to give him an edge. And while it's a tremendous amount of attention, so these children, you know, they do get more food, they do get more resources, it's also an enormous amount of pressure.
Couple other things I want to be sure to ask you about before we are out of time. In a really intriguing chapter called How to Eat Your Parents, you talk about one matter that is often a point of obsessive focus with young adults in China, and that is securing their first apartment. Why is owning an apartment so important in China, even if it often stretches one's resources right to the edge to secure one?
So this is one of the major pressures that young men in China feel. You are not considered an eligible bachelor until you own property, until you own an apartment. It's described as anchuangan, the want for a feeling of safety and security in China, because so much has changed. And the older generation in particular remembers a time when the government would, it was a communist system, so they took away and redistributed land. Having an apartment symbolizes security at a time when China feels like it's changing so fast that people want something to hold on to. But because of, I mean, if you look at the numbers, the real estate market in China is unbelievable. So the young population, the young male population in China is strapped for cash. They're trying to figure out, how do I buy an apartment but also be able to eat? So they turn into kunlaozi, they turn into parent eaters, because they have to ask their parents, who they, by the way, should be looking to take care of in traditional Chinese, in the tradition of Chinese, you know, they don't have a retirement system, they have their children. But because of the price of the apartment, an entire family, grandparents and parents, have to chip in so that their son can buy an apartment and get married. Why is that so important? Because the family unit is still the thread in the fabric and the sort of tapestry of Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. Having a family and creating that family unit is still so essential to Chinese tradition, because they don't really have religion, but they do have family.
And you tell us that a lot of young Chinese see on television not just images from America, but even images on Chinese television that paint a picture of the most elaborate of living situations. I mean, like lives of the rich and famous, but China style, that of course is quite disconnected from what the reality is for many of these young people. In just a minute or so, can you just touch on the fifth chapter of your book, which is called Sex for Fun: The Quiet Revolution, and say a word about how the young people of China are approaching this important human matter very differently than was once the case in their homeland?
Absolutely. So China is in the middle of a sexual revolution. And I write, you know, before we imagine sort of wild sex romps, it's the difference between not having sex before marriage and having it. So the transition has become, in China, there in, I think, 1985, only 15% of the population was having sex before marriage. It was akin to sin. You know, I said earlier that China does not have religion, but it was seen as morally impure to have sex before marriage. Now, over 85% of the population is having sex before marriage. And in cities, that number is even higher. And it's part of this want to enjoy the moment. There's a saying, "Jin jiao you jiu, jin jiao zui." It means today we have booze, so today we drink. It's sort of an ancient way of saying YOLO, you only live once. And this young generation says, you know, as we modernize, sex and sexuality is an essential part to our emerging identity. So it's not wild and it's not crazy hookup culture, but there is an evolving sexuality in young China.
Mm. There's also, by the way, a very interesting chapter in your book on what it is like to be young and gay in China. And of course, you touch on all kinds of other matters as well that we do not have time to explore today. But I hope our listeners will make a point of seeking out your fascinating book again, called Young China: How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World, published by St. Martin's Press. Zach Dykewald, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. Thanks for taking an interest. It's clear that you've read the content. It really means a lot.
You're very welcome. Thanks again. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to welcome back to our studios award-winning illustrator Ed Steckley, who specializes in illustrating children's books. He actually was a guest on The Morning Show maybe almost a decade ago as a guest of the Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. And I got to know Ed Steckley again when he became a member of the cast of the Racine Theater Guild's amazing production of Mamma Mia. We'll probably talk about that a little as well, but mostly about his career as an illustrator. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. By the way, on Wednesday, paleontologist Dr. Thomas Carr from Carthage College. Thursday will be Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. On Friday, a preview of the Racine Theater Guild's production of Into the Woods, which opens this coming weekend. Today's going to be a hot one, cloudy and hot, a 40% chance of rain, and a high today of 89 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 65 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny but not as warm, a high of 82 degrees. Very pleasant on Wednesday with sunny skies and a high of just 76 degrees. We'll warm up, however, next weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and Classical News.